The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with an article from the June 10th, 2024 issue of the New Yorker magazine, the books section. What does Freud still have to teach us? Come for the Oedipus Complex, stay for the later troubled musings on the fate of humanity, by Merv Omri. There are more than 30 full-length biographies of Sigmund Freud in circulation today. Why keep writing them? Generally, there are two justifications for a new biography. An obscure archive may have come to light, changing what is known about the subject. Or it can become clear that earlier biographers have misunderstood or even abused existing sources. In the absence of a discovery or a scandal, what hangs in the balance for the second or third or 30th biographer must be a significant reinterpretation of the subject's ideas, where they came from, what they mean, and how they have been transmitted to us from increasingly alien times and places. With Freud, the possibilities for interpreting his life are limitless, as he well knew. In an 1885 letter to his wife, Martha, written when he was 28, he boasted that he had burned all his letters, notes, and manuscripts, which one group of people as yet unborn and fated to misfortune will feel acutely, since you can't guess whom I mean, I will tell you. They are my biographers, he said. He added, let each one of them believe he is right in his conception of the development of the hero. Even now I enjoy the thought of how they will all go astray. Freud's wish for the birth of his unborn biographers was also a curse laid upon them. Under his ferocious hubris ran an equally ferocious insecurity. He had yet to publish anything of significance, and the ideas that made him famous, repression, infantile sexuality, the libido, and the death drive, were still far in the future. Nearly all Freud's biographers have brandished this letter as proof of their daring in accepting his challenge. Like children, some have done so respectfully, others with contempt. His official biographer, the Welsh psychoanalyst Ernest Jones, met Freud in 1908 at the inaugural International Psychoanalytic Congress in Salzburg and never strayed far from his side. In the mid-50s, Jones published a three-volume behemoth, The Life and Work of Sigmund Freud, which proceeded with the tender, painstaking and sometimes misleading attention of an oldest child cataloging his deceased father's belongings. The historian Peter Gay's Freud, A Life for Our Time, which appeared 30 years later, reads like the work of a clear-eyed younger son. Anchoring Freud's origins in the unstable project of 19th-century Austrian liberalism and the vexed insider-outsider status of the Jewish bourgeoisie, Gay systematically linked each of Freud's major writings to its historical epoch. Despite their differences, Jones, the disciple, and Gay, the scholar, were both completists. No one has improved on their essential and extraordinarily vivid books. Efforts to do so, for instance, Elizabeth Rudnesko's Freud and His Time and Ours, published in 2014, read like the imitative, if perfectly serviceable, remembrances of latecomers to a funeral. After those two monumental works, the next wave of Freud biographies seemed to respond to a strong reciprocal impulse. After all, he had written the most influential biography of us, of man, a creature of pleasure who had been civilized into unhappiness, and of mankind, its members instinctively bound by eros and aggression. Reciprocity, however, can take the form of gratitude or vengeance. Frederick Cruz's Freud, The Making of an Illusion, published in 2017, is a work of propaganda so savage that one cannot help but imagine its author as a disowned son. His Freud is lazy, insecure, abusive, and deluded, and the practitioners who have followed him are saps and chumps. In contrast, the British psychoanalyst Anna Phillips's devoted and meandering Becoming Freud, The Making of a Psychoanalyst, published in 2016, offers no new details about its subject's life. Periodically, though, the call to biography is occasioned by an urge to construct a Freud for our time, a time that resembles Freud's own in its apprehension and instability. This was an urge whose repetition was foreseen by W. H. Auden in his 1940 poem, In Memory of Sigmund Freud. It reads, "When there are so many we shall have to mourn, when grief has been made so public and exposed to the critique of a whole epoch, the frailty of our conscience and anguish, of whom shall we speak?" This doctor was the poem's answer, an important Jew who died in exile and who spoke to all the exiles who long for the future that lives in our power. As Matt Fitch observes at the beginning of his biography, Sigmund Freud, published in 2022, there has been a Freud for the 1920s, Bengal, and 1930s Tokyo, a Freud for the early days of the Bolshevik Revolution and for modernist poets, a Freud for apartheid South Africa. The past few years have given us a Freud for the pandemic, a Freud for Ukraine, a Freud for Palestine, a Freud for transfemininity, a Freud for the far right, and a Freud for the viper's nest that is the 21st century American university. The latest biography, Mortal Secrets, Freud, Vienna, and the Making of the Modern Mind, published by St. Martin's, is by Frank Tallis, a British clinical psychologist and a crime novelist. His popular series, The Lieberman Papers, is set in an opulent fin de siècle Vienna and features Dr. Max Lieberman, billed as literature's first psychoanalytic detective. Tallis is not the first to give us a Freud for Vienna. The intellectual historian Karl Schwartzky's Fin de Siècle Vienna, Politics and Culture from 1980 remains the standard bearer. But what Tallis lacks in novelty or political verve, he makes up for in sheer entertainment, drawing inspiration from the briskly plotted intrigue of his crime fiction. Quotation is jettisoned in favor of dramatic paraphrase. Chapters are anchored by colorful Viennese personalities, including patients from Freud's case studies, Anna O, Dora, Ratman, Wolfman, and the melancholy aristocrats and philandering artists of his milieu. Reading Mortal Secrets is like waltzing around a crowded ballroom past quivering gold leaf and sternly curved flowers, while your partner murmurs in your ear very elegant, very precise summaries of primal parricide and the topographical model of the mind. The experience is not just entertaining. It is refreshingly honest. Tallis, to echo Freud, has no hobby horse, no consuming passion. His biography intends to synthesize and clarify and to dispel any baseless speculation about his subject. He uses his lifetime of professional expertise to adjudicate freely and fairly between the Freud bashers and the fanatics who have treated his works like scripture. Their battles, he points out, have made it difficult to assess the importance of a thinker who, though routinely debunked, indelibly shaped our ideas about the self. He is obviously important, Tallis writes. But how important? Every biographer of Freud must contend with the gruff, withholding story that he told about his own life in An Autobiographical Study, which he published in 1925, at the height of his success. From the start, Freud adopts a tone of pure facticity. Quote, I was born on May 6, 1856 in Freiburg in Moravia, a small town in what is now Czechoslovakia. He continues, my parents were Jews and I have remained a Jew myself. He describes his family's move from Freiburg to Vienna when he was three without detail or emotion. His references to his early influences, the Bible, Darwin, Goethe, are glancing. The formative mentorships of Ernest Burke and Jean-Martin Charcot and his professional relationships with Joseph Breuer, with whom Freud co-authored the 1895 book Studies on Hysteria, are swept aside after a few paragraphs. Martha makes a single strange appearance in a digression about how she persuaded Freud to stop experimenting with cocaine. It is the fault of my fiancé that I was not already famous, he complains. Their six children and eight grandchildren are largely absent. The faithful disciples are subordinated to the founding institutions of psychoanalysis. The unfaithful Carl Jung is dismissed in an icy parenthetical. Militantly impersonal in his style, Freud narrates his life through a series of lucid and economic summaries of the ideas that defined his career. First, repression, then infantile sexuality, and finally, the grand battle between Eros and the death instinct within individuals and across civilization. It was the first of these ideas, he writes, that gave rise to all the others. Quote, it is possible to take repression as a center and to bring all the elements of psychoanalytic theory into relation with it. End quote. The subject opened one of his earliest papers, Screen Memories, from 1899, which recounted a conversation that Freud had had with a patient, a 38-year-old man whose family had moved when he was three from the small town where he was born to a big city. They had suffered long years of hardship, the man confided. I don't think there was anything about them worth remembering, he said. He had thrown himself into his studies, achieving considerable intellectual and financial success. Only once, when he was 17, did he return to his hometown for the summer. On the trip, he fell in love with a daughter of a family that he was staying with, a girl who wore a striking yellow dress. His most perplexing childhood memory, he told Freud, was of picking bright yellow flowers in a meadow with his two cousins, a girl his age, and a boy slightly older, while a farmer's wife and a nursemaid watched them. Quote, the little girl has the nicest bunch, but we two boys, as if by prior agreement, fall upon her and snatch her flowers from her. She runs up the meadow in tears, and the farmer's wife consoles her by giving her a big slice of black bread, end quote. Yet this patient did not really exist. He was, Tallis writes, Freud's invented doppelganger, an immigrant who had left his home only to learn how solitary, how grim the reality of growing up was in comparison with childhood. He wondered, what if he had never left his hometown? What if he had married the girl he had fallen in love with that summer? Freud knew that all people ask questions like these, and that upon asking them, life suddenly appears in split screen, with one side drenched in color and the other black and white, with long interludes in which nothing much seems to happen. Human beings, Freud wrote, find reality unsatisfying quite generally, and for that reason entertain a life of fantasy in which we like to make up for the insufficiencies of reality. These unrealizable fantasies, which were too melancholy to confront, had to be repressed or pushed out of consciousness. Yet the repressed wishful impulse continues to exist in the unconscious, he explained. at opportune moments, the impulse sent into consciousness a disguised and unrecognizable substitute for what had been repressed. The screen memory, a substitute, emerged almost like a work of fiction. It was constructed out of superimposed fantasies of sex and satiation. In this case, the deflowering, as it were, of the little girl, whose flowers were the same vivid yellow as the dress of Freud's first love, and also the bread, a source of material comfort. The screen memory, associated with the wish to return home and find love waiting there, represented a compromise between knowledge and illusion. It was a bearable sign of an unbearable disappointment. Screen memories belongs to the earliest period of Freud's writings, along with the interpretation of dreams, 1900, the psychopathology of everyday life, 1901, and jokes and their relation to the unconscious, 1905. All of them concern a repressed wish's substitutive forms, memories, dreams, slips of the tongue, and jokes, which Freud wrote about with great charm. An enthusiastic popularizer of his ideas, he imagined his audience as anyone who had not managed to turn his wishful fantasies into reality. Not titans of industry or artists, but ordinary people who longed for more than what they had. The act of attending to their substitutions, of fantasizing, provided a daily experience of creativity, surprise, humor, and interpretive activity. One needed to have only the courage and determination, Freud urged, to heed the minor poetry of the unconscious. The idea of repression makes Freud's interest in sex logical, Tallis writes. The realization in screen memories that the figure of the demanding, sexually aggressive child persisted in the psyche of the self-possessed adult put Freud on the scent of his next major discovery. Infantile sexuality. His 1905 book, Three Essays on the Theory of Sexuality, described how the child passed through a predictable series of relations with his mother, his father, and his own body that guided his libido. Sometimes, however, the pathway of the libido was disturbed by an ailing parent, a harassing sibling, thereby releasing a desire that had to be repressed. The substitute was not a gratifying aesthetic experience, like a screen memory or a joke, but a disruptive symptom expressed in disturbances of other non-sexual somatic functions. In Freud's patients, symptoms range from an aversion to food and drink, to migraines, a persistent cough, momentary aphasia, and obsessive-compulsive behaviors. Infantile sexuality lent the child's life a generic shape and a sense of fatedness. In The Interpretation of Dreams, Freud had noted the prevalence in his neurotic patients of the Oedipus dream, having sex with one's mother, which he understood as an intense and agitated expression of natural filial love. The persons who are concerned with a child's feeding, care, and protection become his earliest sexual objects. That is to say, in the first instance, his mother, Freud wrote. The father, a rival for the mother's attention, presented an obstacle. Indulging his libidinal attachment to his mother, a boy behaved in discomfiting ways, watching his mother undress, sleeping in her bed, proposing marriage, and wishing his father were dead. One may easily see that the little man would like to have the mother all to himself, Freud wrote. This behavior may have seemed mild in comparison with incest and patricide, but Freud held that it was essentially the same, a difference of degree rather than of kind. Crucial to Oedipus' story is that he did not realize that Queen Jocasta was his mother. His was a tragedy of misrecognition, and his eventual self-blinding literalized his blindness to the nature of his desire. A similar blindness afflicted Freud's patients, he observed, and nowhere more powerfully than in their relationships with persons who can revive in them the picture of the mother and the father. Lovers, teachers, bosses, priests, and of course, psychoanalysts. The patient would act out the same patterns that it structures his encounters with his parents, often without understanding what he was doing or why. This displacement of emotion, which Freud called transference, manifested as a stormy demand for love or in a more moderate form. Some people understand how to sublimate the transference, how to modify it until it attains a kind of fitness for existence, he wrote. Others, failing to identify the source of their longings, would never solve the riddle of their need and their hostility. The Oedipus complex, with its touch of mythological grandeur, has obscured more radical claims about infantile sexuality and, by extension, sexuality in general, that Freud made in his mid-period writings, especially his 1909 lectures at Clark University. Against the fantasy of the innocent angelic child, Freud insisted on a baby as a rapacious pleasure seeker, a thumb sucker, ear pulling, cheerfully masturbating creature lacking shame, loathing, and morality. Tallis summarizes Freud wonderfully in this quote: "A baby is a promiscuous voluptuary with irregular tastes." The baby was all instinctual need, attending to his own body with profound concentration, deigning to allow his mother to tickle and stroke and nurse him while he mewled with contentment. He would enter a latency period before the onset of puberty, when the behaviors he exhibited as a child would be checked by adults. But his narcissism and his Oedipal grief would remain forever submerged in his unconscious. Freud's theory of infantile sexuality allowed him to pursue a startling critique of civilized sexual morality, as he called it, in his 1908 essay of the same name. It was a critique that he prosecuted subtly, at first, with an ironic and counterintuitive definition of the sexual as anything improper. Impropriety encompassed any sexual activity that had, quote, given up the aim of reproduction to pursue the attainment of pleasure, end quote. A child sucking his mother's breast for comfort, oral sex between married people, and anal sex between men. Civilization, Freud argued, did not teach people to repress specific sexual activities per se. It taught them to repress the inutile pleasure of sex and to understand as sexual or improper any experience of pleasure that exceeded the act of reproduction. Freud observed that all these crazy, eccentric, and horrible things really constitute the sexual activity of people. Laying the irony on thick, he suggested that all his readers were enthralled to the uselessness of pleasure, that they had been educated into heterosexual object choice, marriage, and having children, and that this education entailed a lifetime of repressing one's unruly libidinal instincts. People do not show their sexuality freely, Freud wrote. To conceal it, they wear a heavy overcoat woven of a tissue of lies, as though the weather were bad in the world of sexuality. Among Freud's biographers, there is much prurient speculation about his own sexuality. How erotic was his early relationship with the otolaryngologist Wilhelm Fleiss, who propounded an intimate connection between the nose and the genitals? Did Freud have an affair with his sister-in-law Minna, who was prettier and more attentive to his research than Martha? On such points, Tallis is level-headed, where others have been foolishly excitable, like naughty boys peeking through keyholes. Tallis writes, "The truth of the matter is that we can never know what really happened." Instead, he stresses what Freud repeatedly stressed, that psychoanalysis, in its encounters with so-called perversions, has no concern whatever with such judgments of value. Freud made this point with increasing vehemence in his later work. The demand for a uniform sexual life for all disregards all the disparities innate and acquired in the sexual constitution of human beings, thereby depriving fairly large numbers of sexual enjoyment and becoming a source of grave injustice. Psychoanalysis erased the difference between perverts of all stripes, gays, lesbians, sadists, masochists, fetishists, exhibitionists, and faithfully married heterosexuals. For all of them, Freud held, the aim was the same, transforming your hysterical misery into common unhappiness. The scandal of infantile sexuality and the Oedipal plot have distracted many of Freud's biographers from the final phase of his career, when he broadened his fierce and unsettling gaze from the history of the individual to the history of humankind. His post-war writings, Mourning and Melancholia, 1917, Reflections on War and Death, 1918, Beyond the Pleasure Principle, 1920, Civilization and Its Discontents, 1930, and Moses and Monotheism, 1939, attempted to comprehend a world besieged by war and illness. Man was ensnared in a battle of the giants, Eros versus Thanatos, the libido against what Freud named the death drive. The libido drew people together. The death drive tore them apart, repeatedly, across every epoch, and with a bleak determinacy that led Freud to conclude that the aim of all life is death. A strong pessimism had marked Freud's work from the beginning, but it had been tempered by his quiet appreciation of the poetry of the unconscious. Yet, the consolations of fantasy could not withstand the First World War, which sent his sons to the front and bankrupted his practice, leaving his family in Vienna starving. In 1915, he drafted a short and hopelessly poignant essay, Transience, on why people mourn. Mourning over the loss of something that we have loved or admired seems so natural to the layman that he takes it quite for granted, Freud wrote. He continued, but for the psychologist, mourning is a great mystery. The libido bound itself to objects, a lover, a homeland, a profession, that it absorbed into the ego, incorporating them into one's sense of self. The loss of these objects freed the libido to seek substitutes. It also provoked a wrenching displeasure which, Freud marveled, we have at present no hypothesis to explain. Mourning, he observed, compelled people to create more ferocious attachments to whatever objects were still present to them. His primary example was the war, which made our fatherland small again and made the rest of the world remote. And that in the face of war's losses, the love of the fatherland, the affection for our neighbors, and pride in what we have in common have been suddenly reinforced. The preoccupation with death in his writings of the 20s and 30s was hardly surprising. The streets of Vienna teemed with veterans suffering war neuroses and civilians suffering the traumatic neuroses of peace, he observed in Beyond the Pleasure Principle. While he was writing that book, his daughter Sophie, his best beloved child, died of the Spanish flu at the age of 26. A terrible pathos hangs over Beyond the Pleasure Principle, which is concerned with absences that can and cannot be mastered. At its center is a diptych of loss. On one side of it, Freud tells the story of Sophie's older son, Ernst, who delighted in playing a repetitive and apparently pointless game. He would take a wooden spool attached to a piece of string and throw it into his crib, out of sight. Then he would pull it back, cooing, "Ooh," and shout, "Da!" when it appeared. Freud speculates that the game, Forta, gone, there, is evidence of the child learning to renounce his instinctual need for his mother. He compensated himself by staging the disappearance and return of the objects within his reach, learning to win pleasure from his mastery of loss. On the other side of the diptych are situations in which people repeated painful relations passively and unconsciously, such as the man whose friendships all end in betrayal by his friends, or the lover, each of whose love affairs with a woman passes through the same phases. They presented no thrill of novelty, no compensating pleasures. Instead, they modeled the compulsion to repeat, leading Freud to conjecture that the death drive is a need to restore an earlier state of things, an annihilatory instinct that exceeded sex drives and ego drives. As a psychoanalyst Ilse Gubrich-Mittis discovered, Freud inserted the death drive into Beyond the Pleasure Principle after Sophie's death. The concept is the impersonal marker of a profoundly personal loss. More losses followed. In 1923, Sophie's younger son, Heinz, died of tuberculosis. The same year, doctors found cancer in Freud's mouth. No wonder, then, that his next book, Civilization and Its Discontents, stands as his most anxious and disordered work. It can be difficult to determine its central theme, so frantically does Freud shift his topic and tone. He begins by expressing his skepticism about religion, but he also avows interest in a sense of oneness with the universe, an oceanic feeling corresponding to a more intimate bond between the ego and the world around it. Some individuals pursue this bond through prayer. Others seek it in love, which Freud seems to have hardened his heart against. "We never have so little protection against suffering as when we are in love," he warns. The greatest testament to the human sense of oneness is civilization itself, man's mastery over space and time, in the form of shared aesthetic and political projects, beauty, order, religion, nationhood. Yet civilization had not increased the amount of pleasure that men could expect from life. The telephone that allowed one to hear the voice of a child thousands of miles away would not be needed had the railways not allowed the child to move far away. The ideas that united people and shared projects would not be necessary if civilization had not sacrificed both desire and aggression on the false altar of human perfectibility. Civilization contained within its structures the urge to destroy them. Whoever recalls the people known as the Mongols under Genghis Khan and Tamerlane, the conquest of Jerusalem by the pious Crusaders, or indeed the horrors of the Great War, will be obliged to acknowledge this as fact, Freud wrote. Existence was the struggle between the life drive and the drive for destruction. It was impossible to know which would win. In a letter to Albert Einstein, written in 1932, the year before the Nazis came to power, Freud expressed his hope that everything that promotes the development of civilization also works against war. Yet he feared that he belonged to a minority. "How long must we wait before the others become pacifists as well?" he wondered. Shortly after the Anschluss in 1938, the Gestapo detained and interrogated Freud's youngest child, Anna, then raided the Freud's home. The family fled to London, where Freud died a year later. delirious, inarticulate, and in agony from the cancer that had eaten away at his jaw. The end of his story makes it difficult to disagree with his dejected assessment of civilization. "The life imposed on us is too hard to bear," he wrote. "It brings too much pain, too many disappointments, too many insoluble problems." But it would be wrong to end on such unremitting pessimism. No matter his private grief, Freud always allowed the analytic pendulum to swing in the opposite direction. The smallest but brightest entry among the Freud biographies is Writing on the Wall, a 1944 tribute by the modernist poet H.D., who was treated by Freud in the 30s. Dedicated to Sigmund Freud, blameless physician, its chapters flip between H.D.'s memories of her sessions with the professor and memories of her father and mother, her stillborn child, and her flight to Greece under a gathering mist of madness. The poetic spirit that animates psychoanalysis, the subterranean glow of fiction, of fantasy, of useless pleasure, finds its apotheosis in H.D.'s free associative style. She had evidently watched Freud listening just as carefully as he had listened to her speaking. He was like a curator in a museum, surrounded by his priceless collection of Greek, Egyptian, and Chinese treasures, she wrote. She found him withdrawn, quiet, a little wistful. When he grew annoyed with her, he beat his hand on the headpiece of his famous couch. Recreating Freud as a mixture of myth and reality, H.D. offered the reader a singularly intimate account of the method of a man who claimed intimacy with everyone but seemed to offer it to no one. Writing on the Wall was published several decades after it was written in a volume called A Tribute to Freud, along with excerpts from H.D.'s diaries and the letters that Freud wrote to her during and after her analysis. Her side of the correspondence is not included, but in May 1936, she seems to have sent him an especially affectionate letter for his 80th birthday. His response was brief but tender. "I had imagined I had become insensitive to praise and blame," he wrote. "Life at my age is not easy, but spring is beautiful, and so is love." This idea would stay with H.D. and later become a form of psychic protection when air raid sirens screamed across the London sky. She writes, "The professor himself proclaimed the Herculean power of Eros, and we know that it was written from the beginning that love is stronger than death." Next, from the June 17th, 2024 issue of The New Yorker, the book section, "Should we kill some wild creatures to protect others? Where humans have tilted the game in favor of one species, some believe we should cull predators to save their prey. Others think it's a mistake to pick sides." By Elizabeth Colbert. The northern spotted owl is about a foot and a half high, with very dark eyes, a greenish beak, and a rim of feathers called a facial disc that makes it appear to be regarding the world with worried perplexity. Like most owls, northern spotteds are nocturnal, but unlike most of their brethren, they are picky. They can live only in old-growth forests in the Pacific Northwest. Their diet is restricted and seems to consist mainly of flying squirrels. They're incapable of building nests of their own, and so, to raise their young, they rely on tree cavities or on basket-like growths that are produced by arboreal infections and known evocatively as witches' brooms. The spotted owl's fastidiousness produced one of the great environmental conflicts of the 20th century. By the late 1980s, it was estimated that only 1,500 breeding pairs survived. Since the owls depended on old growth, The only way to save them, according to biologists, was to preserve the northwest remaining stands of ancient trees. The timber industry countered that leaving those trees untouched would cost thousands of jobs. The two sides adopted increasingly confrontational tactics. Loggers raced to cut down the most valuable timber before their opponents could secure court injunctions. Protesters blocked forest access roads and chained themselves to tree trunks. The police brought in heavy machinery to bulldoze their encampments. Environmentalists dressed up as owls and shouted, "No more clear cuts." Sawmill workers drove around with bumper stickers that read, "I like spotted owls, fried." Eventually, the birds, or their non-avian champions, won what came to be known as the Timber Wars. In 1994, the Clinton administration set aside some 24.5 million acres of forest to protect the owls. But the victory has proved a hollow one. Northern spotted owls have continued to decline. A few years ago, a team of scientists analyzed data from 11 study sites in Oregon, California, and Washington State. They found that since 1995, the number of spotted owls at the sites had fallen by at least 50%. At some sites, it had dropped by more than 60%. These figures have set off a new conflict, what might be thought of as the Timber Wars, T-I-M-B-R-E. Researchers believe that what's now standing in the way of the spotted owl's recovery is another owl, the barred owl. The barred owl's haunting call, often rendered as, "Who cooks for you? Who cooks for you all?" is commonly heard in the eastern United States and Kansas. Spotted owls have a higher-pitched, four-beat call. The ranges of the two species should not overlap. But during the past several decades, almost certainly owing to the human transformation of the landscape, barred owls have pushed west. Far less finicky than their spotted kin, they are also bigger and more territorial. Barred owls compete with spotted owls for prey and nesting sites, sometimes killing them outright. Last fall, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service proposed a plan to try to save the northern spotted owl by eliminating tens of thousands of its competitors. The idea is to lure barred owls into the open by playing digital recordings of their calls. Then, removal specialists are to pop them using a shotgun of 20-gauge or larger bore. The slaughter of animals is, of course, routine. Every day, around the world, some 900,000 cows, more than 1 million goats, and nearly 4 million pigs are processed into meat. Roughly 100 million lab rats and mice are dispatched each year in the U.S. alone. Countless other rodents are trapped or poisoned because they're seen as pests. Compared with this carnage, Fish and Wildlife's plan might be considered a mere drop in the abattoir. And yet, the proposal raises its own set of concerns. As a rule, people don't interfere with predation. When a lion in the wild takes down a wildebeest, it's considered fair game. But where can you or a lion go these days that's genuinely wild? If people, either intentionally or accidentally, have tilted the game to favor one species over another, do people then have an obligation to undo the damage? Or does that just compound the problem? Hugh Warwick is a British ecologist and writer. In Call of the Wild, Killing in the Name of Conservation, published by Bloomsbury, he considers a dozen recent campaigns to assist one species by removing another. These include efforts to cull gray squirrels in favor of red squirrels, mice in favor of albatrosses, rats in favor of puffins, and pythons in favor of bobcats. As Warwick makes clear, there are many more examples where these came from. invasive species, he points out, are among the main drivers of extinction today, up there with habitat destruction, pollution, and climate change. Warwick's attachment to animals runs deep. My earliest memories had me tied to animals more than people, he writes. He stopped eating meat 35 years ago and generally avoids animal products, although he confesses he sometimes makes an exception for cake. Warwick's particular passion is hedgehogs. He lectures about hedgehogs, serves as a spokesman for Britain's Hedgehog Preservation Society, sports a tattoo of a hedgehog, and performs hedgehog-related stand-up comedy. There are, alas, no hedgehog jokes in Call of the Wild. In their native habitat, which stretches from Italy to Scandinavia, European hedgehogs are in trouble. It's estimated that in Britain, their population has dropped by half just since the year 2000. And yet, hedgehogs also pose a threat. They are generalists that will eat just about anything from slugs and millipedes to dog food, and when introduced into a new ecosystem, they can wreak havoc. Think the tale of Mrs. Tiggy Winkle crossed with the strange case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. The Uist, a group of islands in Scotland's Outer Hebrides, are an important breeding ground for several species of wading birds, including ringed plovers. In the 1970s, someone deliberately imported hedgehogs to the islands. As they multiplied and spread, the hedgehogs developed a taste for the eggs and chicks of wading birds. By 2003, the Uist aviation populations were crashing, and the Scottish government, in concert with the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds, decided that something would have to be done about this. The something that they settled on was trapping hedgehogs and killing them via lethal injection. Many in Britain opposed the plan, including Warwick. He joined a group called Uist Hedgehog Rescue, whose goal was to round up the island's hogs and ferry the captives to the mainland, where they could be released. Brian May, best known as the lead guitarist for Queen, helped to finance the effort, and Tim Rice, best known as the lyricist for The Lion King, offered his estate in Scotland as a refuge. But the relocations and lethal injections made little difference. After a decade, hog numbers on all but one of the U.S. were just as high as before, and the whole effort was abandoned. Removing all the hedgehogs from the U.S. is pretty much impossible, Warwick concludes. From this story, one might imagine Warwick to be opposed to killing in the name of conservation. In fact, though, he's conflicted. Conservation is really complicated, he writes. There is an old saying that anyone who gives you a simple answer to a complicated problem is either a liar or a fool. In the case of culling, even the complications are complicated. Some are ethical, some are practical, some are emotional, and some are a combination of all three. Consider the water vole. Native to Europe and Western Asia, water voles look a bit like overgrown hamsters. They live in holes dug in riverbanks, and they will, when threatened, plop into the water to retreat to their burrows. Water voles have a lot of enemies, but none as effective as American minks, which were imported to Britain for fur farming. Some farmed minks got loose. Others were let loose by animal rights activists. Because minks, too, are excellent swimmers, they can pursue voles into their homes. Nowadays, minks are widespread in Britain, and voles are scarce. The water vole has the unenviable distinction of being the country's fastest declining mammalian species. Warwick confesses that he has a soft spot for water voles, which he describes as mini beavers. At one point, Warwick pays a visit to Tony Martin, the chair of a group called Waterlife Recovery Trust. The group's goal is to eliminate Britain's minks entirely. This is a much bigger challenge than ousting the hedgehogs from the Uist, but Warwick finds himself impressed by Martin's battle plan, which includes the use of electronic traps that send a text message when an animal has been caught. The traps, known as remote monitoring devices, are, according to Martin, game changers, as volunteers no longer have to check them constantly. I can't stress enough, these are glorious creatures, Martin says of the mink. It is just that they are the wrong animal in the wrong place at the wrong time. We humans made a mistake by introducing them to this country, and it's a mistake which we can and should rectify. Later, Warwick speaks to Mark Beckoff, a professor emeritus at the University of Colorado Boulder. Beckoff, an advocate of what's become known as compassionate conservation, argues that one mistake doesn't justify another. Mostly we kill to make ourselves feel better, to feel like we have tried to clear up a mess of our making, he tells Warwick. We think we have the right to intervene, but human exceptionalism is not something I want to be a part of, Beckoff says. And if you take the time to look at our interventions, we have not been doing a great job of it. Of all the nations in the world, none is more devoted to killing in the name of conservation than New Zealand. This is mostly due to geography. New Zealand was the last major landmass to be settled, and when the Maori first showed up, around 1300, it had no terrestrial mammals except for a few species of bat. As a result, its native animals, which included giant insects, fantastic birds, and the last remaining species in an order of reptiles that crept among the dinosaurs, were mostly defenseless against furry interlopers. The Maori brought with them Pacific rats, which caused, or at least contributed to, the extinction of dozens of species, including the long-billed wren, the South Island snipe, and the Aurora frog. When the British arrived in the late 18th century, they brought along more rats, ship rats, and Norway rats. Then the colonists began importing European species that they missed having around, deer, hedgehogs, rabbits. The rabbits reproduced so prolifically that, according to the country's government, they reached plague proportions. In an attempt to reduce the leporine population, New Zealanders next imported stoats and ferrets. Many of the purposeful introductions have proved just as disastrous as the accidental ones. In 2016, New Zealand officially launched a campaign to rid itself of introduced predators. The main targets are stoats, possums, and rats, but feral cats and hedgehogs are also on the list. A blog post I once came across supporting the work of eradication was titled, Mrs. Tiggy Winkle, Serial Killer. Laura McLaughlin, the author of Hedgehogs, Killing and Kindness, The Contradictions of Care and Conservation Practice, published by MIT, is an anthropologist who grew up in New Zealand. Her work focuses on the complex ties between humans and other species. Just as the predator-free campaign was getting underway, she moved to England to immerse herself in the culture of hedgehog enthusiasts. McLaughlin settles in Bristol, about 100 miles west of London. She volunteers at Prickles Hedgehog Rescue, a rehabilitation center in the nearby village of Cheddar, and interviews hedgehog champions who are working to make their gardens and communities more hospitable to hogs. The creatures hibernate in the winter, so some gardeners put out boxes for them to curl up in. Others leave out rotting logs, which attract the sorts of insects that they like to eat. Still others cut holes in their fences to aid hedgehogs in their nocturnal wanderings. McLaughlin tries to persuade one of her neighbors to forego repairs to a crumbling garden wall so that hedgehogs can squabble over it. He ignores her. After a year or so, McLaughlin heads back to New Zealand, arriving in Wellington just in time for an annual event called Pest Fest. Visitors to Pest Fest are encouraged to become wildlife champions of a distinctly unsentimental variety. Instead of comfy boxes, they are urged to put out spring tracks. McLaughlin is so upset by the festival's gung-ho attitude toward killing that she breaks down in tears. Wellington turns out to be at the bleeding edge of the predator-free campaign. Thanks to a lot of trapping and poisoning, several rare birds can now be seen fluttering around the city. McLaughlin expresses gratitude toward those who have worked to keep species like these around and says that she might also choose culling when the alternative is the loss of such magnificent creatures. But she continues to be disturbed by the portrayal of those species labeled pests, which she sees as the bestial equivalent of dehumanization. how the other is made present to us. Through which stories and technologies they are mediated matters deeply, she writes. And she can't or won't give up on hedgehogs. When she comes upon one and then another that seem to be ailing, she takes them in, fattens them up, and releases them, even though she knows they're on the city's enemies list. Then she worries that she saved the hogs only long enough for them to toddle into the nearest trap. Though we may view our attitudes toward nature as natural, really, she argues, they are socially constructed. There's nothing either good or bad about hedgehogs, but thinking makes it so. She spends a lot of time trying to sort out the tangle of her emotions, but comes to believe that there's no consistent way through them. Ambivalence, she eventually decides, can be productive. As it happens, right around the time that McLaughlin left New Zealand, I went there to report on the Predator Free campaign. One day, I visited a couple who owned a beautiful farm north of Auckland. Out of fondness for such creatures as kiwis, they had dotted their farms with traps, some powerful enough to kill a cat, and periodically they had to make the rounds to empty and reset them. Kiwi, which are flightless, nest in burrows, making them highly vulnerable to mammalian predators. On the day of my visit, one of the first traps checked contained a stoat that had evidently been dead for some time. The stoat was writhing as if possessed by some zombie-like force. When the husband poked at it, it split apart to reveal a mass of maggots. There's no doubt that predator elimination or culling or killing in the name of conservation is ugly work, and it's no less disturbing for being well-intentioned. But the question that confronts U.S. Fish and Wildlife and New Zealand's Department of Conservation is, what's the alternative? In many cases, it's just a different kind of death, the demise of a species, which inevitably is preceded by the demise of individuals. I would love there to be a way of fixing the messes we have made that did not rely on such lethal action, Warwick writes. But the desire to take killing off the table will not take death off the table. People can shoot barred owls or let barred owls do in spotted ones. Either way, we're implicated. As Warwick observed, it's far too late to debate whether humans have a right to intervene in the natural world because we have, as a species, already intervened. This is the bind we're in, and unfortunately, there is no bloodless way out of it. We've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and we'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you very much for listening to North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.